According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, hourly pay in the US is up 1.4% from a year ago. So if wages are increasing, why doesn't it feel like it?
Why is everything so expensive?
Yep, that's it. $70.
Companies are out here gaslighting us.
It feels like getting ripped off by Wall Street because that's exactly what's happening.
It's time to stop the price gouging.
When you split the economy into its 900 or so different industries, two-thirds have become more concentrated since the 1990s. According to a 2017 analysis by The Economist, the pendulum has swung in favor of incumbent businesses. American companies collectively spend $3 billion a year on lobbying. In regulated industries that don't face competition from imports, healthcare, airlines, and telecommunications, prices are at least 50% higher than in other rich countries. In a recent report on global wealth inequality, Oxfam International called corporate and monopoly power an unrelenting inequality-generating machine. The report states that the five richest men on Earth, four of them American tech magnates, have more than doubled their wealth since the start of the decade. The U.S. alone is home to 806 bona fide billionaires, and their combined wealth has nearly doubled since 2017. Contrary to the promises of Reaganomics, most of us stopped expecting the riches to trickle down a long time ago, but it doesn't make the growing inequality any easier to stomach. A recent analysis of Federal Reserve data by CNBC found that the top 1% of Americans accounted for 30% of the nation's wealth at the end of 2023, almost $45 trillion. On the other end of the spectrum, 11.5% of Americans were living in poverty in 2022. That's 37.9 million people. These numbers seem outrageous, and they are, but they're hardly unprecedented. They're quite reminiscent, actually, of what we saw at the turn of the 20th century when titans of industry like J.D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, and J.P. Morgan made enormous fortunes on the backs of underpaid, overworked, and generally exploited laborers. In 1897, the top 4,000 families in the U.S. who accounted for less than 1% of the total population controlled about as much wealth as the other 99% combined. Just 4,000 families had more wealth than 11.6 million people. Faced with these figures, I wanted to understand how we escaped the brutal inequality of the Gilded Age and then ended up backsliding to the spot we're in now. How did we crack down on the robber barons of old, and how might we revive those tactics to take down the tech billionaires of today? Why do corporate monopolies pave the way to fascism? And what can these periods teach us about the ongoing battle for our country's soul? This is how antitrust laws could save democracy. Roll the intro. As tech giants keep conglomerating and getting bigger and bigger, they're continuing to collect all our data, but they're not the only ones with access to your information. Have you ever tried doing a Google search of your name? I did a search of my name and found some of my personal contact information online, and I don't love that for me. Okay? The internet can create a real danger to your personal safety in a lot of ways, not least of which being the ability for anyone anywhere to find your information, either to locate you or to steal your identity. And that's spooky. Data brokers sell your information to scammers, spammers, and anyone else who may want to target you. Your full name, email, home address, health records, your relatives, it's all out there. And that's why I've been using Aura, the sponsor of today's video. Aura shows me which data brokers are selling my information and automatically submits opt-out requests for me. Cleaning up my information not only helps reduce the amount of spam I get, but it protects me from hackers who could use that information to then help them access my social media accounts, my bank accounts, or other sensitive information. And I don't know if you saw this, but AT&T recently revealed that over 73 million customer records, both existing and former customers, were released on the dark web. They recommend those affected use strong passwords, monitor account activity, and consider credit freezes or fraud alerts from credit bureaus. But Aura does all of this for me. And best of all, I don't have to download several different apps just because a company couldn't keep my data secure. And we'll talk later in this video about how AT&T has a role in the antitrust media conglomerate discussion. But if my info was compromised in the AT&T data breach, I wouldn't worry because Aura is always on. It's always doing the work of keeping me safe. And if protecting your privacy is something you're interested in, you can go to aura.com/Lija to start your 2-week free trial, linked below in the description. Thanks, Aura. Turns out that all that glitters isn't gold. In fact, it may just be a thin layer of something shiny painted over a real turd. Mark Twain coined the phrase the Gilded Age in his 1873 novel, satirizing the obscene greed and political corruption he observed running rampant across post-Civil War America. It was an era of technologically driven industrialization that demolished small businesses, built colossal companies, and accelerated the pace of life itself. Products weren't safe for consumers, and workplaces weren't safe for employees. And fake news abounded. Sound familiar? It was the age of social Darwinism, a philosophy that helped businessmen sleep soundly, even as they spent their days exploiting workers and undermining competitors. Social Darwinism posited that survival of the fittest was a law of nature that should apply to civilized society. If people were poor, it was because they were weak, dumb, and probably lazy. Expending resources to elevate such people wouldn't just be a waste, but a violation of God's will. Forget inheriting the earth, the meek were destined to be eliminated. This perspective fueled eugenics campaigns designed to eradicate the physically or mentally disabled, and wages so low and danger so high that young children not only went to work, they often died there. Maybe if children weren't so frail and weak, they would have survived. It's God's will, okay? Social Darwinism gives us essential context to understand how men who claim to be devout Christians in their private lives could inflict such horrors on so many. Social Darwinism paired perfectly with its ideological cousin, laissez-faire economics, to usher in the Gilded Age. Laissez-faire translates to let it happen, an approach rooted in the belief that the economy is a self-balancing system. During the Civil War, the White House established a cozy alliance with Wall Street, basically taking the approach that the economy was Wall Street's purview and not anything that the government should interfere with. This meant that not only was abuse rampant within companies, but also between them. Competition was fierce and exemplified the era's dog-eat-dog natural selection logic. And what's the most straightforward and lasting way to dominate your competitors? Eat them. Or, in business terms, own them. The great merger period between 1896 and 1904 saw some 1,800 manufacturing firms merge into 160 horizontal combinations, most of which dominated their respective industries. These giant conglomerations, called trusts, aimed to organize the economy into one monopoly per sector, a vision of pure economic autocracy. A trust was a new type of industrial organization where the voting rights of a majority of shares of multiple firms within the same industry were entrusted to a single small group of men or trustees who were then able to prevent competition among the companies they controlled. During that decade of mass consolidation, J.D. Rockefeller took his Standard Oil empire from commanding 10% to 90% of the market share by offering competitors the same choice that Genghis Khan gave those he conquered: join the empire or face complete destruction. He'd charge predatory prices, create exclusionary cartels, and maybe most troubling, throw around his political influence by getting particular laws changed just to shut out potential competitors. Rockefeller once commented on monopolization, saying, "Growth of a large business is merely a survival of the fittest, a working out of a law of nature and a law of God." What's so wild about this is that by the time the Great Merger era kicked off, a law giving the government the power to curb monopolies had already been on the books for half a decade, but nobody was prepared to use it. The Sherman Antitrust Act was passed in 1890 with almost unanimous support in both the House and the Senate. It directly responded to the first wave of outrage against the rise of trusts and the inequality that they bred. Section 2 is among the law's most controversial. Every person who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize or combine or conspire with any other person or persons to monopolize any part of the trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations shall be deemed guilty of a misdemeanor. The Sherman Act was so loosely worded that would-be prosecutors had plausible deniability about the definition of critical terms like combination, conspiracy, monopoly, and even trust itself. Even as violence raged in the form of demonstrations like the Homestead Steel Strike of 1892 and the Pullman Strike of 1894, the Sherman Act lay dormant. Prosecutors did nothing to enforce it. Fun fact about George Pullman, the railroad sleeping car king who fired 3/4 of his workforce, cut wages by 30%, refused to reduce prices or rents in the company town he controlled, and then had 10,000 federal troops sent in to break the resulting strike, yet he was keenly aware of how despised he was. But rather than change his behavior, he arranged to have his coffin sealed with lead and buried at night in a steel and concrete vault 8 feet underground to prevent his scorned workers from taking revenge on his corpse. Good thing his actions were all ordained by God, I guess.
Yikes.
Anyway, Pullman croaked in 1897, but the Sherman Act received what many thought would be its death blow 2 years earlier in 1895. The Supreme Court ruled in U.S. v. E.C. Knight Company that one company controlling 98% of all sugar refining in the country did not constitute a control of trade, and it seemed that all was lost for antitrust. But as it turned out, the problem wasn't a toothless law so much as spineless leaders, and that would all change in 1901 when President McKinley got shot. President William McKinley was comfortable with the status quo. Government over here and business over there. Lots of bourgeois backslapping for all. Then in 1901, word got out that J.P. Morgan was planning to buy out Andrew Carnegie and create U.S. Steel Trust. Sherman Act be damned. In fact, antitrust enforcement was so far out of mind that instead of issuing even a public comment on the merger, the White House held a dinner in Morgan's honor. Then on September 6, 1901, a man reached out to shake the president's hand outside the Temple of Music in Buffalo and shot him twice in the abdomen. Upon hearing the news, J.P. Morgan is said to have slumped into his chair and lamented, "This is sad, sad, very sad news." It's unclear whether this reaction was personal or because a few weeks before, then Vice President Theodore Roosevelt announced the time had come for the state to assert its authority over the trusts. McKinley's untimely demise meant that the cowboy was coming. As you might recall from history class, TR wasn't a real low-key guy. He appreciated grandeur and had no inherent objection to big business. Unlike his predecessors, TR didn't buy into the idea that economic policy shouldn't be subject to the will of the people and the regulations of the government. He saw the hands-off approach to Wall Street as an egregious corruption of the democratic system. "When aggregated wealth demands what is unfair," he once said, "its immense power can be met only by the still greater power of the people as a whole." One of TR's first acts as president was to order his attorney general to investigate J.P. Morgan's Northern Securities Company and review its legality under the Sherman Act. The company was dissolved, and the three recently united railroads were restored to independent operation. During his 8 years in office, Roosevelt's Department of Justice filed 45 corporate antitrust cases and achieved numerous breakups. The dissolution of J.D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil Trust was among the most notable dissolutions. In 1904, journalist Ida Tarbell published a 19-part account of Standard Oil's history, digging up and documenting previously unknown abuses and stoking public outrage. In 1906, TR's cabinet unanimously agreed to sue Standard Oil, and in 1911, the court ordered that the trust break into 34 constituent parts, a few of which are still thriving today. Standard Oil of New Jersey became Exxon, Standard Oil of New York became Mobil, and Standard Oil of California became Chevron. And yes, it is weird that Exxon and Mobil were allowed to merge in 1998, but we'll get to that. To be clear, Roosevelt wasn't an antitrust fundamentalist. He drew a line between what he considered good trusts and bad trusts. Good trusts thrived on merit, creating superior products more efficiently and reducing prices along the way. Bad trusts were those abusing competitors, workers, and the political process. As he put it, "We begrudge no man a fortune which represents his own power of sagacity if exercised with entire regard to the welfare of his fellows." As we've already discussed, this era wasn't characterized by high regard for human suffering. Nonetheless, Roosevelt successfully turned the tide and animated the Sherman Act for decades to come. His successor, President William Howard Taft, pursued 75 antitrust cases, continuing to chip away at the private power monopolists had managed to amass and pointing precedent in the direction of action against trusts. Woodrow Wilson won the 1912 election on an economic platform of regulated competition, in stark contrast to his challenger, a Teddy Roosevelt-endorsed politician. Roosevelt, ever the believer in big government, now espoused a vision for a society of regulated monopolies, in which the state would partner with a small group of monopolists who would each enjoy totally responsible dominance over their respective industries. Responsible. The 1912 election was one of the only times the American public has been given an explicit choice between competition and monopoly. And we picked competition, aka Woodrow Wilson. During his time in office, Wilson beefed up antitrust protections. In 1914, he signed the Clayton Act, banning specific practices like predatory and discriminatory pricing. The same year, Wilson created the Federal Trade Commission, giving it the authority to safeguard competition and protect consumers through investigations and lawsuits. Thanks to the tireless efforts of muckrakers, unions, and progressive activists, as well as a slew of tragedies like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, a new era of prioritizing the people seemed to have arrived. Over the next few decades, regulations on everything from food safety and fire exits to child labor and overtime pay proliferated. Competition became a cornerstone of the American economic ethos and identity, reinforced by the terrifying examples from countries like Italy and Germany, where monopoly power easily translated to authoritarian rule. Between about 1940 and the late 1970s, capitalistic competition was seen as nothing less than an antidote to fascism. It was clear that an unequal economy had enabled tyranny in Germany, and that for the US to protect itself from the same fate, it must aggressively pursue antitrust goals. As one report from the Secretary of War concluded, Germany under the Nazi setup built a great series of industrial monopolies in steel, rubber, coal, and other materials. The monopolies soon got control of Germany, brought Hitler to power, and forced virtually the whole world into war. Fair enough, considering the main German monopolists had spent the 1930s throwing their considerable weight behind the Nazi regime, becoming deeply allied with and enmeshed in the war effort. As Tim Wu puts it in his book The Curse of Bigness, the monopolist and the dictator tend to have overlapping interests. During the Nuremberg trials, 24 executives from the IG Farben chemical cartel, just one of Germany's main monopolies, were tried for war crimes, including practicing human enslavement in occupied territories. The firm was broken into six separate companies, including one you'll recognize, Bayer. With competition firmly embedded in the public imagination as a necessary protection of democracy itself, the European community, today the European Union, rushed to create its own antitrust laws, which were modeled after the Sherman Act. The irony of this will hurt more later in this video. The post-war years were something of a golden age for antitrust enforcement. Emboldened by perilous examples from abroad, antitrust enforcers unleashed a shock treatment campaign on American business. In 1950, the government authorized even sharper teeth for the Clayton Act in the form of the Anti-Merger Act. The law offered new ways to prevent the buildup of giant firms before they snowballed out of control. And we've talked a few times on this channel about the anti-communist craze of the 40s and 50s, one that led to not only the blacklisting of celebrities and laypeople alike, but also to the state-sanctioned execution of suspected communists, and to a dramatic government propaganda campaign linking American values with the fight against communism. On the one side were the sex-crazed, homosexual, atheistic communists hell-bent on spreading their godless dogma across the entire world. On the other side were pious, Christian, red-blooded Americans, the last bastion of freedom in a world moving towards totalitarianism. That became embedded in the American psyche. It is a large part of the conservative narrative to this day. So it's wild when you realize that in the midst of all this paranoia and propaganda emerged what today would be considered a pretty progressive stance on the economy. Bust up monopolies, regulate big businesses, and increase taxes on the wealthy. By the late 1960s, the share of national income going to the top 1% had fallen to 8%. A far cry from the extreme inequality at the turn of the century, when the top 1% controlled more money than the other 99% of the population combined. And we have this era of anti-communist fueled enforcement to thank for two major monopoly takedowns that arguably changed world history. But to understand how those cases were resolved, we first need to discuss how the entire philosophy behind antitrust was unraveled in just a few decades. By this point, conservatives who despised seeing liberals in power were of the opinion that the FTC had grown far too big for its britches. Enter this fucking guy, Robert Bork, popularizer of the Chicago School of Antitrust, but perhaps best known for his failure to get confirmed to the Supreme Court in 1987, resulting in the delightful verb to bork a candidate. If only we'd borked Kavanaugh, am I right? You might remember Bork from my video on Watergate. When Nixon attempted to have the special prosecutor investigating the Watergate scandal fired, both his attorney general and deputy attorney general resigned in protest. Third in line was our friend Bork, who ultimately came to the rescue and canned the special prosecutor. What a guy. Bork may have been a dick, but he was no dummy, and his legacy is a testament to the damage that ideas can do. As a law student at the University of Chicago in the early 1950s, Bork took a class with one Professor Aaron Director. Despite not having a law degree or a PhD, Director was nonetheless a leading academic in law and economics, who amassed an impressive cadre of devoted students, Bork chief among them. Director's main thesis was Supreme Court case law was wrong, and worked against consumer welfare. He popularized the idea that competition was actually bad because it protected smaller, weaker companies when bigger, more efficient companies would provide lower prices for consumers. The idea being that lower prices were the main way to measure consumer welfare. Director's consumer welfare obsession marked a significant departure from the entire mindset animating antitrust enforcement up to that point. Where previously competition was lauded as an essential element of democracy, it was suddenly being undermined as potentially counterproductive. Plus, this obsession with costs ignored a lot of the other bad outcomes of monopoly, like stagnation and, you know, fascism. As the idea bloomed into a school of thought, the Chicago School of Antitrust, Bork became its most evangelistic disciple. Bork took Director's concept a step further, arguing that it wasn't a new reading of the law at all, but a return to its original intent. Because there's nothing conservatives love more than cherry-picking history to force deference to an imagined past. In the early 60s, the Chicago School's ideas were relegated to what had been called the lunatic fringe of economic theory. However, within a few decades, it would become the dominant outlook of the majority of Supreme Court justices. The turning point came in 1966 with the publication of a paper called Legislative Intent and the Policy of the Sherman Act. Bork argued that in any antitrust case, the plaintiff simply had to prove to a certainty that the complaint of behavior had actually raised prices for consumers. According to modern antitrust expert Herbert Hovenhamp, Bork's analysis of the legislative history was strained, heavily governed by his own ideological agenda. Not a single statement in the legislative history comes close to stating the conclusions that Bork drew. And yet, Bork's repackaging of antitrust as a tool of judicial restraint in the face of what he considered overly progressive judges became hugely popular among conservatives. According to Bork and his followers, antitrust law, driven by anything other than consumer welfare, was the law of the libertine, degenerate, and debauched. Put that on a t-shirt. And thus, the culture war had arrived in antitrust law. Chicago school adherents offered a vision of monopolists as gentle giants, whose lone, pure-hearted goal was to make the economy more efficient, and who cowered in fear of potentially ruinous competition. The way these guys saw it, the Sherman Act had been weaponized against some of America's most exceptional entrepreneurs, and the injustices had to stop.
I'm sorry that people are so jealous of me, but I can't help it that I'm popular.
The Chicago school made inroads into mainstream thought through, what else? Lobbying by wealthy and powerful business interests. It was never popular among the public, but that didn't matter. They didn't need the public support, as the main changes to antitrust policy were being made by regulators and judges with very little democratic accountability. And this is the issue we always come back to. Money in politics undermines democracy. And part of the reason corporate lobbying is so effective is the same reason that monopolies are so dangerous. The fewer firms there are, the easier it is for them to conspire against us. The more concentrated the industry, the fewer parties to split the spoils of exploitative policies. And this lobbying is really only available to big businesses. If you think about it this way, a middle-class tax cut might save each member of the middle class $500 a year. But to achieve that cut, someone has to invest about $50 million into lobbying. No individual member of the middle class has the proper incentive to make that kind of investment just to save $500 per year. But when you translate a similar initiative to a smaller group of incredibly wealthy businesses whose lobbying efforts stand to save them millions, suddenly the math starts mathing. The notion that bigger is better, meaning more efficient, has come up multiple times in this video already. And this idea isn't entirely without merit. Economies of scale is most basically the principle that larger producers will outperform smaller producers. This is true, but only to a point, after which increasing size creates more inefficiencies. Take, for example, General Motors. The assembly line helped supercharge productivity in the first half of the 20th century. But after decades of dominance, the company became a bloated dinosaur stuffed full of middle managers, redundancy, and waste. Anyone who's worked in corporate America for a large company has seen this firsthand. What are they even doing in there? Speaking of bloated dinosaurs, now we're ready to talk about the last two behemoths the DOJ went after while antitrust acolytes were still in charge. Some consider the IBM and AT&T lawsuits huge failures, but without them, the entire telecommunications and tech landscape would be very different. Suing a monopolistic corporation ain't easy, and it ain't cheap, and the IBM and AT&T cases cost the U.S. government an astonishing amount of time and money. The IBM suit came first in 1969. In the lawsuit, the DOJ claimed that the company had illegally maintained its monopoly through sabotage and fraud. Over the course of the case, the government's presentation took 104,000 pages of transcript. IBM called more than 850 witnesses and presented 12,280 exhibits. The case dragged on for 13 years in what has been called the antitrust division's Vietnam. While that case was still ongoing in 1974, the Nixon administration sued AT&T. At the time, it was the largest firm in the world, employing more than 1 million people and barreling towards its seventh decade of dominance. Depending on how you count, AT&T held 6 or 7 distinct monopolies, controlling local, business, and long-distance telephone service, as well as the physical telephones and accessories, plus emerging markets like online services. AT&T claimed that maintaining absolute control over the entire process was the only way it could guarantee efficiency and control quality, and it did everything it could to squash any competition that came its way. Unsatisfyingly, neither the AT&T nor the IBM case was decided by the Supreme Court, thanks to none other than Ronald fucking Reagan. Reagan, already firmly in the pocket of the same conservative lobbyists who helped convert judges to the Chicago School, ended both lawsuits on the same day. AT&T settled, and as part of the settlement agreement, was divided into 7 smaller companies. As for IBM, after more than a decade in court, the suit was simply dropped. Not necessarily the major antitrust win that activists were hoping for. That being said, both of these cases did have profound impacts on American industry. When IBM released its first personal computer in 1981, it was under such close government scrutiny that it didn't buy or even exert excessive control over the firms that made its components, among them Intel and Microsoft. If the government hadn't sued IBM when it did, the independent software industry as we know it would have been impossible. On the telecommunications side, AT&T's breakup led to an explosion in innovation. Without competitors being allowed to sell things to plug into a new phone jack, we wouldn't have gotten the answering machine or the home modem, the technological prerequisite for the internet revolution. But unfortunately, hindsight is 20/20, and at the time, both cases were widely condemned as pointless and wasteful. After dropping the IBM lawsuit and settling with AT&T on that busy day in 1982, Reagan transitioned to Chicago school ideology through judicial appointments and enforcement tactics, or lack thereof, virtually ending the government's fight against monopolies. A new era had arrived, repackaging old social Darwinist ideas about who deserved to live and justifying the gutting of social programs, tax cuts for the wealthy, and general disdain for anyone who failed to get rich. In the 1980s, greed was good.
Champagne for everybody! Look what I found in my pocket! Look! A year's salary right here! Fun coupons!
I'm talking about this.
Defenders of 1980s era Reagan policies argue that this deregulation allowed for the growth and eventual domination of many American multinational companies on a global scale. And conservatives love the idea that America is the best in the world. In the conservative imagination, the American dream is about enabling exceptionalism. And that's it. Once you buy into the idea that some people are just better than others, and that we all flourish and perish according to our own merits, then allowing great men to fulfill their destiny is the highest purpose of a free society. The global dominance of America's tech giants is a testament to the dominant value system that conservatives hold so dear, that reaching the top is much more important than the people you step on along the way. And that has become embedded into the American psyche and the American dream itself. By the 1990s, Microsoft had fulfilled that conservative wet dream of world dominance with a monopoly of more than 90% of the market share. Microsoft was also known for using brutal tactics to undermine its competition. After its particularly shady takedown of the dominant web browser of the time, Netscape, remember her, the Clinton administration sued Microsoft in what would be the last major lawsuit against a monopolist until recently. The case sailed through the lower courts, but then just as it was about to hit the Supreme Court, Bush Jr. took office and his Department of Justice opted to settle instead of seeking a traditional breakup. During Bush's 8 years in power, the DOJ brought exactly 0 new monopoly antitrust cases and failed to block any major mergers. In 2004, Justice Antonin Scalia espoused the idea that monopoly power was the only meaningful reward for enterprising men, writing that the charging of monopoly prices is not only not unlawful, it is an important element of the free market system. Obama expressed intention to crack down on monopolies during his presidency, but too large a portion of the judiciary had already bought into the Chicago School's logic, and his time in office ended up being marked by some of the most egregious consolidations of the modern era. Google got away with 214 acquisitions, including the purchase of Waze, AdMob, and YouTube. Amazon made 91 acquisitions, among them Zappos, Diapers.com, and Soap.com. Then there's Facebook, which managed to string together 67 unchallenged acquisitions, including WhatsApp and Instagram. That Live Nation Ticketmaster merger also went down on Obama's watch in 2010. But we can thank Trump for AT&T AT&T's acquisition of DirecTV and Time Warner, which brought AT&T's size back up to the scale it enjoyed in the 1980s before its trust was busted in that lawsuit our government spent years and millions of taxpayer dollars to fight. In 75% of U.S. industries, fewer companies now control more of their markets than they did 2 decades ago. And when there's less competition, companies have more freedom to charge whatever they want. We're seeing the consequences of that now in everything from drug prices to the cost of a box of cereal. However, the Biden administration has pursued some of the most aggressive antitrust lawsuits we've seen in decades. Though you might not know it because the White House has done a trash job promoting the good things that the current president has done, and his 2024 campaign ads aren't helping. Here's what they should be showing you.
Amazon, here we come.
The Federal Trade Commission is suing Amazon for alleged anti-competitive business practices.
Google is in court as the U.S. takes on the company's search dominance in the biggest antitrust trial in 2 decades.
We allege that Apple has employed a strategy that relies on exclusionary, anti-competitive conduct that hurts both consumers and developers.
Live Nation was pressuring venues to use Ticketmaster.
May I suggest respectfully that Ticketmaster ought to look in the mirror and say, I'm the problem. It's me.
This merger will not go through.
And whatever the result, the sheer act of bringing antitrust lawsuits is a big deal. In fact, the administration has been so aggressive in its pursuit of policing big business that, according to the New York Times, some dealmakers are holding off on making certain deals in the hope that Biden will lose the election in 2024 to someone with a more lenient approach. But if Biden stays in office, the DOJ says trust-busting efforts will continue. Antitrust may not be the silver bullet solution to wealth inequality, but it does get to the root cause of a lot of our economic woes, especially artificially inflated prices in the face of stagnated wages. And of course, a lot of this would be solved if we got money out of politics so that giant businesses can't buy out our politicians. But if we want to get money out of politics, we need a whole constitutional amendment, which, as we've discussed in previous videos, is a long fight. But when it comes to antitrust, we already have laws on the books that we can leverage while we wait for all the Chicago school adherents still sitting on various benches to die off. Biden's antitrust activities show that he's listening, and not just to traditional old-school activism. In the 1900s, one of the only ways to show support for a cause you believed in was to insert yourself physically in the form of protests, often facing violent retaliation. In the age of social media, our voices are amplified far beyond what any megaphone could accomplish. I know sometimes it feels like we're just screaming into the void online, and sometimes we are, but the fact remains that less than a year after TikTok was flooded with sobbing Taylor Swift fans who couldn't get Eras Tour tickets, the DOJ filed an antitrust lawsuit against Live Nation. I'm not saying that other forms of engagement, including protests, don't matter. I'm just saying that maybe raising our voices matters more than we thought. In recent years, the Chicago School of Antitrust has fallen out of fashion, and a new group of thinkers is coming to the fore, the Neo-Brandeisians, who take their name from former Supreme Court Justice and economic advisor to Woodrow Wilson, Justice Louis Brandeis. They believe, as Brandeis did, that the curse of bigness poses a profound threat to democracy. A proponent of economic democracy, Brandeis envisioned America as a place of industrial freedom and openness to competition, yet with an economy that yielded spoils for all. He believed that the right to life guaranteed in the Constitution should be understood as the right to live and not merely exist. To this end, men must have the opportunity of developing their faculties, and they must live under conditions in which their faculties may develop naturally and healthily. This also meant freedom from industrial domination, exploitation, or so much economic insecurity that one could not really live without fear of unemployment and poverty, which is exactly where we're at now. Brandeis despised the growing American culture of overwork, whether self-inflicted or mandated by exploitative employers. A good career, he insisted, was one that created the conditions for human thriving. And that actually sounds pretty nice. For their part, the Neo-Brandeisians suggest that the best path forward will involve taking antitrust policymaking away from the courts and giving that responsibility back to Congress and regulatory agencies. They're also in favor of democratizing the merger process by making filings transparent so the public can engage in serious debate instead of reading about what happened in transcripts years after the fact. Most importantly, they want to see a return to the original values of the antitrust laws as written, to prioritize competition and to understand competition as a key to our democracy and our freedom. You can prioritize competition in your daily life by buying from small businesses. Every purchase is a tiny vote for the version of the world you want to live in. And look, I'm not saying to never buy from the big guys again or to throw your iPhone in a river or that consuming shit under capitalism capitalism is the answer to everything. I'm just saying that being mindful of where you're shopping, because we all have to do it sometimes, and whose businesses you're supporting can go a long way. If you enjoyed this video, I hope you'll consider supporting my small business by checking out my Patreon community or clicking the big join button below to become a member here on YouTube, where you'll get early access to ad-free extended editions of all of my videos. The extra content is the same whether you join as a YouTube member or on Patreon. Your support helps to keep these videos free for everyone and further our mission towards legal and political education for all. Shout out to my newest supporters, as well as supporters in my royal tiers, and a very special shout out to my multi-platinum supporters, Latranger Lucas, Joshua Cole, Thomas Johnson, Sophia Sams, Anthony Giles, and Brett Piontek. Your generosity makes this channel what it is, so thank you. And if you like this video, you'll also like my video about how lobbying is ruining democracy. Thanks so much for watching. Have a good day. Bye-bye.